Is that, best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I'd been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. Dr. Silkworth sat down with him and explained to Bill his ideas about the physical allergy and the obsession of the mind. And Bill said, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor. Just explained to him why his willpower wouldn't work, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely, this was the answer, self-knowledge. I can almost see Bill. Dr. Silkworth sat down with him and explained to him the allergy and the obsession of the mind. And Bill said, oh, that's what's wrong with me. Well, I thought it was weak will. I thought it was moral character. I thought it was sin. I'm sure glad to find out that I'm sick, both bodily and mentally. And he said, now that I know what's wrong with me, I'll never have to drink again. Self-knowledge would fix it. Let's see where Bill went from there.
But it was not. But a frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining and moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After that time, I returned to the hospital. Now, this is 1934, a year later, the next summer. This was finished. The curtain seemed to me, my weary, despairing wife was informed that it was all in heart failure or delirium tremors. Bill overheard Dr. Silkworth telling Lois about his condition. I would have to develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would have to give me over to the undertaker on their asylum. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacities to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. With all his willpower, he was defeated. Now I was the plunge in the jar, joining the endless procession of sights who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. Now we hear, this is the most beautiful expression I've ever read. I never seen anything more fitting for step one. It's the most beautiful way to say it. No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. This is where Bill took step one. This is where Bill admitted that he was powerless over alcohol, that his life had become unmanageable.
No step one written in those days. But so we can certainly see where Bill took it. He admitted complete defeat. Alcohol had become his master. He was absolutely powerless over that.
They told Bill he was going to have a wet brain or have to be locked up in an asylum. They're trying to scare him. They used to try to scare me not to drink, too. But you can't scare an alcoholic into not drink. He almost welcomed the idea, as they will if you try to scare him, because living drunk is a terrible, terrible thing when you become alcoholic and you're drinking from oblivion. So you can't scare me by telling me what's going to happen to me. I almost knew to welcome the idea myself, you see. He said, trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered him for a bit.
You know, if that should happen to you and I today, if we could reach that point that Bill did, well, probably what we would do is say, well, that being the case, I guess I've got to go to AA. And Bill didn't have any AA to go to. He's in the best treatment facility he knows of. So the only thing he can do, even though he knows what the problem is now, the only thing he can do is leave there and try to stay sober on his own.
No solution, just knowing what the problem is. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink on Armistice Day in 1934. I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted to what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was no happiness, peace, and unselfishness.
Usefulness,
excuse me. In a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. And near that end of the bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen.
And I imagine it was a pretty bleak November. You started drinking on Armistice Day, November the 11th. Now we've been drunk for about 3 weeks. Pretty bleak November for Bill.
With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dare hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. He said, my musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over.
Now, this is Eddie Thatcher, Bill's old drinking buddy.
And he was sober.
And you'll notice that's in squiggly writing. He was sober.
He was amazed. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he escaped. You know, Abby was a member of a very prominent family in Albany, New York. And his father was running for mayor again, and Abby's drinking and shenanigans around Albany was kind of disgracing the family. So he called him in one day and said, Abby, you're really disgracing the family with your drinking. I want you to basically get out of town, is what he told me. I want you to go over there to Vermont to our summer place and stay over there till after the election. And while you're over there, you might as well try to sober up. And if you're not going to sober up, at least try to paint the place up and fix it up, make yourself useful. But basically, get out of town. So he went over there, and he couldn't quit drinking. And he continued to drink, and he, as we heard earlier, he began to paint the house one day, and stood back and was admiring his paint job. Birds were beginning to gather and do some things on his house that he didn't like. So he went in the house and got the shotgun and started shooting at the birds, the pigeons, blowing holes in the side of the house. Well, the neighbors don't like this. So they called the police, and they took Abby to jail and took him before the judge. And the judge happened to be Judge Graves, Roland Hazard and Seber Graves. Seber was the judge's son. This is one reason why it was easy for him to get released. They interceded on Abby's behalf, asking the judge if they could release Abby to their care, that they would take him to the Oxford group, and maybe they could stay sober like he could stay sober like they're staying sober. Well, the judge didn't want to put him in jail any more then than they do now. So he released him to Roland and to Seber, and Seber took him to the Oxford group, and Bill got sober. And after, Abby got sober, I'm mine someplace. Abby got sober. And after some time, Abby moved to the Calvary Mission in New York, and he was staying there for a while, and he remembered his friend Bill. And he wanted to help Bill get over some of the problems that he was in. So he called his friend Bill and asked him if he might come over.
You know, you can notice here how times have changed. We said rumor had it he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. That's what they used to do with people like us back in the 30s and 40s and early 50s. They would stand us just about as long as they could, and then they would haul us in front of the judge. The judge would commit us to the state insane asylum for alcoholic insanity, and we were sentenced there for an undetermined period of time.
Till you got well.
We would stay there until we got well. And some of us stayed in there for years and years and died in there and never came back out of those places. That's what was going to happen here to Abby Thatcher. If it hadn't been for Roland Hazard and Seber Graves, that's exactly what would have happened to him. But now that Abby got sober, he came to see old Bill. And Bill said, I wondered how he had escaped. He didn't know anything about all this had been going on. Of course, he would have dinner, and I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we'd chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing an oasis, drinkers are like that. The door opened, and he stood there fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table, and he refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Well, come, what's all this about, I queried. And he looked straight at me, simply but smilingly, he said, I've got religion. Now, I'm damn glad that didn't happen in my kitchen. I have no idea what I would have done. But here's what Bill did. He said I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little crack about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yeah, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin wouldn't last longer than in preaching.
Maybe showed up with a solution, didn't he? And he didn't like that solution at all. He was aghast at it.
But he didn't know Randy. And a matter of fact, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told him of a simple religious idea.
Step two.
And a practical problem of action.
Steps 3 through 12. They were not written, they were not numbered in those days, but that's exactly what he gave him. He gave him the solution, and he gave him the practical program of action. Now, Bill already knew the problem. Now, for the first time, he understands the problem, the solution, and the program of action. Let's see where he goes with this.
Yeah, it was 2 months ago, and the result was evident it worked. He had come to the passage's experience along to me, if I cared to have it. I was shocked by this, and it's certain I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He had took himself, and was taking step one. Now, he talked for hours. Childhood memory rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice I said on still Sundays, way over there on the hillside. There was the prophet Timber's pledge I had never signed, my grandfather's good nature and contempt of some church folks and his doings, his insistence that the spirits really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. The fears he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled from the past, and they made me swallow hard. Now, Bill begins, just like every alcoholic, he begins to have problems with every solution. And he goes back, reflects back on his childhood. His grandfather had a lot of effect on Bill's ideas. He says, I had always believed in a power greater than myself. Often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, but that means a blind faith in a strange proposition that this universe originates in the center and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested laws and forces and work. Despite contrary indication, I had little doubt that the mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. I'd rather be there so much precise and immutable law and no intelligence. I simply had to believe in the spirit of the universe with either time or limitation. That was far as I had gone. So Bill believed in God, but he never had used this in his life. He was just like everybody else approached. And Ebby was coming from the Oxford group then, which was people practicing first century Christianity. Remember, it wasn't, so it had a lot of religious tones, religious words. Ebby was using all the expressions, and Bill did not like that. So he had a lot of problems. So they, him and Ebby began this discussion, which must have been quite a discussion that morning between Bill and Ebby over God. The menace of the religions are pointed right there.
Here's where I really, really now begin to identify with Bill Wilson.
When I talked to God personally, who had loved, took the human strength and directions, I was irritated. My mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ, I can see the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claim him, like that. His moral teaching most excellent for myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult, and the rest I disregarded. I can identify with that.
There's nobody in here besides me identifies with Bill Wilson. We can see Bill is really having a hard time.
Bill took step one. He took step one already, we saw that. And 10 and 11, Bill is somewhere between steps 1 and 2. He's contemplating these ideas. He's wondering about these ideas. He's reflecting on some of his own teaching and how he resisted that. And his mind began to snapshot against these theories. He was saying to himself, there's got to be a harder way to do this. I mean, this is too simple.
He said the wars which had been fought, the burnings and chicanery that religious dispute had facilitated, made me sick. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging what I'd seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible, the brotherhood of man a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. Oh, I can identify with Bill. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. That he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from a scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and this was not at all. This is where this identification process is so important. Bill knew about, he knew about Evie, and he knew how Evie drank. And he knew that if Evie had been sober for 2 months, some power greater than Evie had to be working in Evie's life. Now, whether Bill liked it or not is beside the point. Evie is sitting there as living proof of that power. That's what you and I have to offer to the newcomer. When we go out here on a 12-step call, we talk to another alcoholic, somebody that knows nothing about any of this stuff. We're sitting there as living proof that this thing works. We're sitting there as living proof that some power, greater than human power, is working in our lives also. Whether the newcomer likes it or not is beside the point. We are the proof of it. Ebby was the proof of it to Bill. And even though Bill could see it in Ebby, he still didn't like it. The bottom of page 11.
Okay. And he said, I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on different footing. His roots grasped a new soil.
He could see that in Eddie.
But despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. Prejudice means old ideas. The vestiges of my old ideas. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. You got to remember that Abby was coming from the Oxford groups, teaching and practicing and trying to first century Christianity, and they were very much involved with the letter of the law. Thank God that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is involved in the spirit of it rather than the letter. He says, I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of the Tsar of the heavens, however loving his way might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. And I think about that meeting with Bill and Abby, and Bill's about half drunk, and Abby's over trying to talk to him about religion. And I've had those conversations. I know how frustrating they are. And I don't know if Abby did this next thing on purpose or where he just did it out of frustration and anger. But he said,
now look out, this is in squiggly writing.
Yeah. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? I suspected, he said, man, I've talked to you about this. I've talked to this, and I'm blue in the face. He said, why don't you just choose your own damn conception? That's the way I imagine it. But that little statement, see, later on came to open the door for literally hundreds of thousands of millions of people. Why don't you choose your own conception of God?
The instant he made that statement, his message changed from a religious message to a spiritual message. You see, religion says this is the way you have to believe. Spirituality says it doesn't make any difference how you believe. The only question is, are you willing to believe? We're no longer talking about religion now. We're talking about spirituality. Now, based upon that, then Bill's ideas change completely. And I've looked at this and I've studied it over and over and over again. And I think the reason it had such a profound effect on Bill Wilson is Bill, just like every other alcoholic, we've never had any problem with our own conception of anything. Yeah. You let us have our own conception of God, then we're willing to talk about this deal. Somebody else's conception, no. I've never seen an alcoholic yet that had a problem with God. Our problem with God was somebody else's conception of God. Let us have our own conception, and we're ready to go. Here's the effect it had on Bill. He said, that statement hit me hard. It melted the ice in Electro Mountain in the shadow I'd lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It took away all arguments from it. He's got nothing else to argue about now. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. And this is when Bill took step two. No step two written in those days. But this is where Bill began to believe in a power greater than himself, based on the idea that he could have his own conception of God.
He also states here, based on a foundation of willingness. Later on, he's going to be talking about building a structure. And the foundation of this structure is willingness. Willingness is the foundation, step one. Willingness is real simple. Willingness is when you come to a conclusion that whatever you're doing ain't going to never work. And you'd be willing to look at something else. So willingness is real simple. Willingness is the foundation. And now he says, upon this foundation of step one, willingness, Chamberlain, we realize there's no way we're ever going to be able to drink. No, not in the future, never. Then that's step one. We fully accept that.
He's really starting to paint a picture in our minds using words. And as we progress on through the book, he's going to continually refer to this structure, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure through which we're going to pass to freedom. Later on, he's going to tell us what that structure is. The foundation of that structure is willingness, which comes from step one. Later on, we're going to see where believing is the cornerstone of that structure. Then eventually, he'll tell us what the structure is. Wonderful, wonderful way to teach, using words, painting pictures in our minds. Okay, now Bill has taken steps one and two. Ebbie starts taking him to Oxford group meetings. But remember, Bill started drinking on Armistice Day. The allergies got him and he can't stop. He finally has to be placed back in the town hospital for the third time, probably about December the 10th or the 11th, somewhere along in there. On page 13, he said, at the hospital, I was separated for alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. Dr. Silkworth withdraws him again. Ebbie comes to visit him in the hospital. And they begin to apply the little Oxford Group program of action in Bill's life to the best of their ability right there in the hospital. We've already seen him take what we know today as steps one and two. Let's see if we can't see steps 3 through 12 on page 13 and 14.
There I humble myself to God, and I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and directions. I admit it for the first time by myself, I was nothing. Without him, I was lost.
We see Bill there doing what they call the surrender. And the first step in the Oxford Group program was surrender. Later on, he changed that to our step three, where we made a decision. So Bill is now taking what we know today as step three in the town hospital.
I ruthlessly face my sins.
We see him now taking what we call step four today. Then they called it examine your sins. And that's what Bill was doing in the town hospital, taking step four.
I became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. I've not had a drink since.
Became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. Later that became what we know today as steps 6 and 7, where we're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character, humbly ask him to do so.
My schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
There he's taking what we know today as step 5. In the town hospital with Ebbie.
Many lists of people that I'd hurt and to whom I felt resentments. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrongs. Never would I be critical of them. I was to write all such matters in the utmost of my abilities.
The Oxford groupers had a step they called restitution. And Bill later on knew no self-respecting alcoholic is going to deal with restitution. So he made that into two steps, and he called them steps 8 and 9. We made our list, became willing to the list, and then began to right those wrongs.
I was testing my thinking by a new guide consciousness. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense.
That statement later became step 10, where we continued to take personal inventory. When we were wrong, promptly admitted it.
I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for directions and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except for my quest bore my useless others. Then only might I expect to receive, and that would be in great measure.
And there we see all the elements of step 11, where we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, so on, and so forth.
Now, my friend promised, when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. I would have elements of a way of living which answered all my problems.
It ought to be the first part of step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So we see Bill in the town's hospital applying the Oxford Group steps or tenets, which later he expanded into the last 10 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now let's see what the result was of the application of these steps.
Okay.
He said, belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things with the essential requirements.
Simple,
but not easy.
The price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father Light who presided over us all.
Poor old alcoholic, in order for us to recover, we have to give up the two things we hold nearest and dearest to our heart. Number one is alcohol, and number two is self-centeredness. Very simple idea, but very, very difficult to do.
And just for a little while before this, Bill was laying in the hospital bed, sick, very, very sick, and he overheard Lois and Dr. Silkworth talking. And she said, he said, Lois, you're going to have to give him over to the undertaker or hire a bodyguard or lock him up, because I don't think he's going to come out of here. And said that these were revolutionary and drastic proposals, the things that the steps that he just took. But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. That God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. See, for a moment I was alarmed, and I called my doctor and asked him if I was still sane. Bill thought he'd gone insane, you see. He said he listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, something's happened to you that I don't understand, but you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. The good doctor now sees many men who've had such experiences. He knows they are real. He said, while I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. Something very, very drastic happened to Bill. He called it the great white flash. He had a spiritual experience. Bill was a very selfish, self-centered individual when he went into that hospital. He practiced or took those steps, those tenets that was presented to him, and he begins to already start thinking about how he might carry this message to other people. He said, while I lay in the hospital, thought came there might be thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might have what had been so freely given me. So something drastically happened to Bill because he started thinking of others immediately.
He said, my friend, and he's referring now to Abby again, had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. And with us, it's just like that. Thank God Bill got that idea in his mind. And he started trying to work with alcoholics just as soon as he got out of the town's hospital. Didn't help any of them for 6 months. When he went to see Dr. Barr, He didn't go there to sober up Dr. Bob. Remember, he went there to keep from getting drunk himself. And he shared his story with Dr. Bob. And sure enough, that effort allowed Bill to stay sober. Dr. Bob found out his problem, and he applied the program of action to a depth he never had before. And the next thing you know, he recovered from alcoholism too. So I think this is a great warning for we alcoholics. If we fail to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, then we're probably going to drink again. And with us, to drink is to die, period. How many, many times have all of us gone out and talked to another alcoholic, and we felt amazingly lifted up after we talked to them? Whether they responded or not was absolutely beside the point. I've never had it fail for me. I always feel better after I talk to another alcoholic. And I think as long as we do that, we're probably going to stay sober.
I had a guy in our meeting the other night say, well, we don't get new alcoholics anymore, so I can't work with other drunks. And all I had to do was just look around the room. Man, there were drunks sitting everywhere that needed help. You know? All I had to do was walk up and start helping. It works that way too, you know, while we're sitting here in this room, if we will. See, it's a design for living that works. It's a design for living that works and worth knowing. And I know personally that the work is really, really hard. It's hard to work with alcoholics. But the pay is good too. You know? You get to stay sober.
Okay, now through the looking at the doctor's opinion, through the reading of Bill's story, by now we should be able to see just exactly what our problem is. We've been able to see another alcoholic who had that problem. We've got to see another alcoholic who had that problem recover from that condition. And if we're a brand new alcoholic out in the state of Kansas, the big book is the only contact we've had with these people. And we've identified with Bill and we've seen him recover. And we've absorbed the doctor's opinion. And surely, we could begin to say to ourselves, you betcha, I've got the same problem this guy had. And if this guy could recover from alcoholism, then just maybe I could too. The beginning of belief, the beginning of hope, that there might be a way out for us. And I don't think it's by accident. The very next thing we see in the big book is the solution to what's just been described to us in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. So let's start looking now at the second goal of the big book. What is the solution to that problem?
Abby presented Bill with a solution, one. And this book is going to present us with a solution, one. And I got this friend back home, said, there's as many different solutions as there are people in AA. And I said, well, if you look at the chapter heading on page 17, you'll see how many solutions there are. There is a solution, only one. And that's what we're going to look at here.
Now, if the problem is powerless, then obviously the answer to that problem, the solution, is going to be power.
Obviously.
And we're going to find in this chapter two powers. We're going to find the power of the fellowship that supports us. We're going to find the power of the vital spiritual experience which changes us. And for those of us who are powerless, which is all of us, if we can take those other two powers, add them together, make them a part of our life, then surely we would be able to find the power to overcome alcoholism. So let's start looking at the actual solution, the power of the fellowship, and the spiritual experience.
We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were just as hopeless as Bill, had the same problem as Bill had. Nearly all have recovered, they have solved the drink problem. Well, average Americans, all sections of this country, and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. Now, he's talking about this group here this weekend. Any AA group, all of us all put together all over the country are this group right here. We represent different occupations are represented here tonight. Different political groups are represented, different economics, different social, different religions.
Different sexes.
Well, this is the most mixed up group of people, in town. Usually when people get together, they have something in common, you know. They have something brings them together to have a meeting. If it's a church, they have the same belief system. If it's education, they're there for a purpose. PTA meeting, union. It's all there's a reason for them coming together. But we have none of the reasons that people usually use to come together. We are normally people who would not mix. We have nothing to mix for. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. You know, the only thing that we have in common, though, is what really binds us, we have a common problem with all alcoholics. And that crosses all the occupations, it crosses political lines, it crosses social lines, it crosses races, because we are all alcoholics. That's what binds us as a problem. Okay. So we are like passengers on the Great Line, the moment after shipwreck, after rescue from the shipwreck. And camaraderie, rejoice, and mark, obeyed us from the vessel. Play the vessel from the steerage to the captain's table. And we are from the steerage to the captain's table. We come all from different walks of life. And to use this illustration, I think about the Titanic as it was crossing the ocean on this final trip. And it had people from every walk of life. And then two extremes. One is the steerage section. That was way down the bottom of the vessel. That's the cheapest way to travel, the worst way to travel. There was noise in it. You could hear the engines and the heat and everything. It was dirty down there.
Dormitory style living and cheese sandwich section.
Immigrants coming over. And then up on the top of the uppermost decks, they had all the finery. And on that floor, on those main floors, they had this beautiful dining room where the captain ate. And all the best people on the vessel would sit this long table with the captain every night. So the guy from the captain's table, he should never have met the guy in the steerage section in his journey. It's like we shouldn't have met in the journey of life. There's no reason we should never have even known each other. Just think about it. All the great relationship we have with each other, we should have never met in life. We have no reason to meet except for a common problem. I think about the Titanic at night when it hit that iceberg. And the guy from the captain's table in his tuxedo jumped overboard. And a guy in his old blue jeans from the steerage section jumped overboard. And they met in the water. And I'm sure that guy didn't ask that guy where he went to church. How much money. They were trying to save their behinds, weren't they? And a common problem overcame all differences. And this is why I think also that it's very important for me, I think, to keep these other issues outside of the rooms. When we bring in money, politics, religion, those things divide us. But one thing that binds us together, we're all alcoholics. That's the binder. There's a great power in that thing, in our fellowship. Okay, the feeling of having shared a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us. That's what supports us. The fellowship of alcoholics now has a lot of strength, a lot of power, a lot of support. We draw it from each other. A lot of great things go on in the meeting, and we don't say nothing.
And now then, he gives us a great warning. He said, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined.
That's right.
In other words, this great power of the fellowship, this feeling of having shared the common peril, this thing called alcoholism which binds us together, is one of the great elements in the powerful cement that binds us together. But that in itself would never have held us together as we're now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree, on which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Not the news of the fellowship, but the news of the common solution. Later on, we're going to see where the common solution is the vital spiritual experience brought about by the program of action. So here he's given us two powers on this page. The power of the fellowship that supports us. The power of the common solution which changes us. And those two powers joined together should be enough to overcome our powerlessness over alcohol. And I think one of the greatest tragedies that I see in the world today, and my God, we see lots of them all over the world, millions of people being killed in wars, dying from AIDS, and God only knows what else going on. Great tragedies. One of the greatest tragedies I see today is right here within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are spending literally hundreds of thousands of dollars every year trying to attract more alcoholics to the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're spending hundreds and hundreds of thousands of hours of men and women work time trying to attract other alcoholics to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when we've got hundreds of thousands sitting around us already in the fellowship dying from untreated alcoholism. They are participating in the fellowship, but they're doing nothing about the common solution. And you see, I blame that on the newcomer. Today I don't. I blame it on us. I blame it on us old-timers in AA. You know, we've let the newcomers coming into AA, bringing the language that was not AA originally into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And many of the old-timers are saying, well, I can't identify with a newcomer, so I'm just going to stay home. And when an old-timer does that, we abdicate our responsibility for Alcoholics Anonymous. We turn it over to the sickest of the sickest, who are the newcomers. And we stand back and say, look at what they're doing to our AA. Now it's time for us to stand up and say, look, all that stuff you learned out there is great stuff, but it has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sit down and let me help you understand this program. Let me take you by the hand and help you as you walk through this program, so you can have a spiritual experience and so you can recover from alcoholism. I think they call that sponsorship. And sponsorship is lacking in AA today. You know, today we think if we go out and pick somebody up and take them to a meeting, we're their sponsor. Hell, a taxi cab driver can take them to a meeting. Those of us who have recovered from alcoholism, those of us who have found the common solution, we know something that nobody else knows. And we can avert death in countless thousands of people if we'll do our job. And we're sitting around in AA letting thousands and thousands of people die from alcoholism that don't need to die from alcoholism. I think it's our responsibility to see that every newcomer understands this page. You bet you the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is a great thing. It's a wonderful thing. But that will not bring about recovery from alcoholism. We're going to have the common solution in addition to the fellowship. We're going to have the spiritual experience, and the only way we can have it is through the program of action that brings that about. Now, Bill spends the first half of this chapter explaining to you and I, and proving to you and I, that fellowship alone is not sufficient. Then he spends the last half of this chapter talking about the common solution. To be absolutely sure we understand what he's talking about here when he said fellowship alone is not enough. Let's look and see why fellowship alone is not sufficient.
Go to page 20, please. It's the top of the page. You know, my sponsor wasn't, he was mean to me. He used to tell me to sit down and shut up. I don't hear that much in AA anymore. I said, you don't know nothing. I said, well, I ever get to say anything? He said, when you get something to say, I'll let you know. Mean.
Mine told me I was going to speak at a meeting. And I said, great, what do you want me to say? He said, tell him your name, you're an alcoholic, and sit down and shut up. That's all you know. He was pretty much right.
Yeah. It's all right to say sit down and shut up, I think. Didn't hurt me any. Okay. You may already ask yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Now, if you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, well, what do I have to do? It's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. Remember, it said that we're going to tell you precisely, specifically, with clear-cut, and exactly with clear-cut directions. Here's one of those words. They're going to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we've done. Now, before going into detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. How many times people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine and lay off the hard stuff? His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, he'd kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. You know,
we're going to look at two drinkers that these expressions would refer to.
A lot of people would have us believe that we're into denial. I was into ignorance when I got here. I didn't know that I didn't know, and I needed to learn. So now we're going to talk about a moderate drinker. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone.
Remember, we talked about them before. They're the ones that have a couple of drinks, get a slightly tipsy, out of control, beginnings of a nauseous feeling. Alcohol is no big deal for them. They can drink it, or they can leave it alone. No problem for the moderate drinker. These expressions that Joe read would refer to the moderate drinker.
So then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. Now, if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warnings of a doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need a little medical attention.
We call this guy the heavy or the hard drinker. They drink like we alcoholics drink, but they're not alcoholics. If a good enough reason presents itself, they only want one or two things. They may learn to moderate their drinking. They do not have the physical allergy. They may quit drinking entirely, period. Never have trouble with it again. They do not have the obsession of the mind. They drink like we drink, but they drink from choice. They are not alcoholic. The expressions Joe read would refer also to the heavy drinker. But what about the real alcoholic? Now, he may start off as a moderate drinker. Many of us did. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. Some of us stayed periodic. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Now, on the rest of page 21, the first to 22, we're going to have a description of the real alcoholic. And when you see one in here that fits you, would you please hold your hand up? We'd like to see if we're in a room full of real alcoholics.
He said, at some stage his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Charlie talked earlier about crossing over into that alcohol, crossing over that line into alcoholism. And I don't know what line he was talking about, but I was drunk when he went over it. I know that.
You read the fellow have been posing, especially lack of control. He does absurd, incredible things while drinking.
Anybody ever do that?
He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
He's seldom mildly intoxicated, always insanely drunk. His disposition when drinking resembles his normal nature, but a little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world. Everybody likes this one.
Yeah.
He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial.
He used to get good looking out of debt just like that when
just
I started
drinking.
He's a part of his genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment. That was some important decision or some engagement to be kept. He's often perfectly sensible and well balanced concerning everything except liquor. In that respect, he's incredibly dishonest and selfish.
Now, everybody holds their hand up on the next one.
He often possesses special abilities and skills, aptitudes, and promising career ahead of him.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of them. And he uses his gift to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. He is a fellow who goes to work, goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. Yeah, the early next morning, he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before.
My wife and I used to buy a lug of whiskey. One to share, that's 3/5. One to share and one to hide from each other.
And within 4 days, he may have literally sell our older house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of hard-pipe sedatives and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative which he takes off. Then he begins to appear in hospitals and treatment centers.
That's the same thing.
And change the name of them.
They used to call them asylums and sanitariums. Today they call them treatment centers. He said, this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary. But this description should identify him roughly. Now, thank God today, if our government has ever spent anything right in the field of alcoholism, perhaps it is in educating the public as to what alcoholism is and what it isn't. And because of that, a lot of the stigma has been removed. And a lot of people are getting to AA today before they have to do all these things that identify the real alcoholic. But I'll guarantee you, if you're a real alcoholic, you found yourself in there somewhere, at least one of them are going to fit you. In my case, practically all of them. One in particular. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets an entire supply away from him. 7 years after I got sober in AA, I owned a 40-acre, 45,000 broiler chicken operation. And 7 years after I got sober, I sold that to a guy. And for years after that, I would meet him once in a while, and he would wave and grin, and he'd say, "Hey, Charlie, we have found another one." And he's referring to partially empty vodka bottles. Behind corner posts, under rocks, in hollow trees, falling out of feed bins. Found them all over that damn place for years. Certainly I found myself there. Now here is the question. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him at one drink needs another debacle with all his attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that it takes one drink? Why can't he stay on a water wagon? The moderate drinker can, the heavy drinker can. Why can't the alcoholic? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We're not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Now, these observations, the ones I just read, would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body.
Would you read that again, please?
The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. It's important we understand the physical allergy, but that's not our real problem. The real problem is in our mind telling us it's okay to drink, when it's obvious not okay to drink. If you ask him why he started that last bender, the chances are he'll offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes the excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this malicious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. As strange as it may seem, there are times we alcoholics tell the truth. Not very often, but once in a great while. And I had a lady who was in Al-Anon. She came to me one time, her husband still drinking. She said, "Charlie, all he does is lie, lie, lie." She said, "How can you tell when one of you guys are lying? I said, "Lady, watch him closely. And if you see his lips moving, he's probably on lie to you." And I said, "Do you want me to tell you how to keep him from lying?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." I said, "Don't ask him those stupid questions. He don't know the answer any more than you do." The truth, strange to say, is usually has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses which are satisfied part of the time. But in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. But they often suspect they're down for the count. There's the word obsession. The great obsession of our alcoholic is someday, somehow, we're going to find some kind of liquor we can drink without getting drunk. Someday, somehow, we're going to find a place we can go to and drink. Someday, somehow. And that obsession is so strong that it makes us believe a lie. An obsession of the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. And our obsession is so strong, it makes us believe that we can drink. Page 24, squiggly writing, first paragraph.
How many of you went to the bars that you went to talked about the allergies, the body, and obsessions of the mind? Mm-hmm. None that I know. When I got here, I was uninformed. I used to say ignorant, but I was uninformed. I didn't know what my problem was. I thought I was a no-good, rotten SOB. And some of those things I was, I said. But I really didn't know what my problem was. You see. Page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink.
Notice that whole paragraph now is in squiggly writing.
Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. As I said, anytime there's a battle going on between the obsession of the mind and your willpower, willpower always wins. Mm-hmm. We are unable at certain times to bring into consciousness with sufficient force the memory and suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We were without defense against the first drink. See, every time I get out of trouble and I quit drinking and I get ready to start drinking again, I could not remember the divorces that I just got out of. I just couldn't remember. I couldn't remember the trouble that I'd just gotten into and get just now paying my way out of. You see, all I could remember was what alcohol was going to do for me. For me.
Not to me.
Not to me, but for me. Because when I didn't drink, the times that I didn't drink, I would be looking through a magazine and I'd see a frosty bottle of that whiskey. Big old drops running down the side of it. I used to say I slobbered a lot when I drank. My mouth watered when I would just see the picture in a book. So I had a real obsession to drink. And if you think about that very long, I don't have any defense against that. I'm going to have a drink. See, there are almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and ready supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Mm-hmm. No defense against that drink. Willpower won't work.
Now, if you burn your hand on a hot stove, chances are you're not going to go back and put your hand on that stove again because you remember how that felt. That's the kind of defense that keeps us from getting hurt. I've told this story 1,000 times. I'm going to tell it again tonight. I remember when I was a kid growing up, way back during the Depression days.
The Hoover boom.
Yeah, the Hoover boom. Joe remembers about this too. This one does.
Yeah.
This one does too, to a certain extent. Anyhow, we didn't have much in those days. We didn't have hot and cold running water. We didn't have forced air heat. In the wintertime, if we had any heat at all, we were lucky. We burned wood, we burned coal, we burned walnuts. And Joe said in his neighborhood, occasionally each other's houses. But it didn't make any difference how poor you were. Cleanliness was still considered next to godliness. every Saturday night, everybody in the family had to take a bath. It didn't make any difference whether you needed one or not. You had to take one on Saturday night. One time in the middle of the winter, Mother had heated the bath water up on the old heating stove in the living room, put it in a number three zinc wash tub sitting behind the stove. Now, the oldest kid in the family, they take their bath first. I'm the baby of the family. By the time it got to me, the crud would be about an inch thick on the water. Mother said, get in there and get yourself clean. And I thought to myself, how in the hell do I get clean in there? But I didn't dare say that to Mama. You didn't talk to your parents in those days that way. I scraped the crud back. I got in the tub of water. I began to wash myself. Old heating stove standing here beside of the tub, red hot. And somehow I managed to bend over and stick my rear against that hot stove. I shall never forget it. A big blister raised on my rear end about as big as my hand. Hurt me worse than anything had ever hurt me up until that time. And do you know, I've never had an obsession of the mind to stick my ass on a hot stove since. Never have I jerked my britches down, backed up to a stove, and said, burn me again. Now, alcohol has burned me over and over and over and over and over and over, just as bad as that hot stove ever burned me. But for some strange reason, left on my own resources, I start thinking about alcohol, and I think only about what it's going to do for me, not what it's going to do to me. The kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove is not existent for we alcoholics. Every time we'll think about the good and not the bad. Last paragraph on page 24. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up may die or go permanently insane. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of a bunch of human beings who are just as powerless over alcohol as I am. Therefore, the fellowship alone is not sufficient. We're going to have the aid of a power greater than human power. Page 25, there is a solution. Let's look at that real fast, and then we'll finish up for the night.
Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcoming, which is processed with force by successful consummation. When we saw that it really worked in others, we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those from whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us to pick up a simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet, that's the 12 steps, and have found much. We have found much of heaven. We have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence which we had not even dreamed. And the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep, effective spiritual experience. Now what did this do? Which revolutionized our attitude toward life, toward ourselves, and toward God's universe. The essential fact of our lives today is absolutely certainly that our Creator has entered our hearts and our lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. Here he gives us a solution. He said, a spiritual experience. Now, he tells us that we've already talked about the fellowship. Now he's given us the real solution, the spiritual experience. Now, you notice about the middle of the page, a little asterisk there beside the word spiritual experience. There was a lot of confusion by the new readers when they bought the book. When the book was new, it told the new reader on this page he had to have a spiritual experience. This was his solution. Well, you know, to a bunch of alcoholics who are not well-versed in spiritual matters or religious matters whatsoever, to be told that they have had a spiritual experience, that's pretty lofty, pretty much over the head. So Bill got a lot of correspondence from people wanting to know, what is a spiritual experience? So the new reader began to write Bill and question him about what did he mean having a what is a spiritual experience? You know, if you're going to have one of those things, you got to have it. It seemed kind of lofty and beyond your reach. And there was, most readers were confused about it. So when Bill republished the second edition of the first printing, he put that aspirant in there, and he put these appendix in the back of the book to explain that what is a spiritual experience. So there's a great, it's hardly impossible to understand that chapter if we don't understand page 569, which is in the back of the book, which is to deal with spiritual experience. It tells you what is a spiritual experience. And if you don't have one of these things, you ought to know about what it is.
Might be a good idea, Matt.
Yeah. Kind of interesting. In the first 16 prints of the book, that asterisk was not there. Page 569 was not in the back of the book, so it just left you hanging that you got to have a spiritual experience. So he said it fully explained on Appendix 2, which is page 569. Later on, he's referring to the asterisk again. He said on page 27, for further information, see page 569. On page 47, it said, please see page 569. Must be very, very important. Let's go to page 569 now and just see what he was talking about.
Yeah. Spiritual, the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening, I use it many times in this book. In this book, we're going to use two terms many times, spiritual experience and spiritual awakening. There are two ways that we're going to can recover. One is a spiritual experience, which we find is very sudden and quick. And one is a spiritual awakening, which is very gradual and occurs over a period of time. Which, upon careful reading, and a lot of alcoholics don't do very careful reading. Show that the personality changes sufficient to bring about a cause of alcoholism and manifests itself in us in many different forms. It occurs in many different forms under these two headings. One is quick and one is slow. In fact, Bill goes on to say there are many personality changes as there are personalities in AA. You know, God's going to work with us uniquely, but they're either quick or sudden. It is true in my first printing, the first book, this is a book that we didn't have an asterisk in it, gave many readers the impression that these personality changes are a religious experience, must be in the nature of a sudden, spectacular upheaval. Happily for everyone, its conclusion is erroneous. You know, the reader got the impression that everybody had to have the same type of recovery that Bill had. In fact, I first read the book, and God in 40 man, he told me about Appendix 2. I felt the same way. I was waiting for something to zap me like Bill got zapped. Now, everybody wants to get zapped. And I was waiting for all that to happen, and never did happen, so I began to wonder about it. Okay. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Bill's recovery is described as sudden. Though not intended to create such impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded in order to recover, they must acquire and meet overwhelming God consciousness for all they want by a vast change in feeling and outlook. You know, everybody wants to have the change like Bill had. And that's what I was looking for, that's what I thought I was supposed to have. Said, among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformation, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experience are what psychologist William James called the education variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of newcomer were aware of this phenomenon before he himself. Most of us will not have the sudden special experience like Bill. Most of us will have the education where we will change gradually as we learn and apply the steps. This is the average recovery. Mine happened to be the plain garden variety change. Other people those changed long before I did myself. Other people used to tell me in the weeks in the program, first 6-7 weeks, how good I was doing. I didn't think I was doing any better at all. Say, so you're doing all right. And I kept on doing what I was supposed to do. There was never no sudden change. He finally realized that he had undergone a profound alteration in his reactions in life. And I finally realized that I had undergone a profound alteration in my reactions to life. I didn't react to life things that I became aware. That's awakening, is when you become aware of the change. I became aware of a few changes. And I know that I didn't bring about this myself alone. What often takes place in a few months of self have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. The sudden spiritual experience was sudden, but this took a few months. With you accepting, I remember saying that they have tapped. When we realize that we have changed, we realize that we have tapped into an inner resource which we presently identify with our own conception of power greater than self. When I realize that, I realize I have tapped into a power greater than is God, which is a power greater than myself. Most of us think this awareness of this power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience, the same value of spiritual experience. For the sudden, one is no better than the other. A sudden spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, they both do the same thing. They both bring about a personality change sufficient to recover. Now, when Bill put this in, he changed the 12th step. The 12th step used to say, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, in the original Red Book. Now, when he realized most people will not have a spiritual experience. A spiritual experience is kind of rare. Most people will have spiritual awakenings. So the 12th step was changed to say you have to have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We are more apt to have a spiritual awakening than a spiritual experience. Very few people have seen spiritual experience in the fellowship, but it is dead rare. I've been fortunate to be around long enough, work with enough people that have seen four or five of them, and they are very rare. And they don't occur in very often. But the people I noticed that had them were very, very, very sick people. Now God reached a little further to give these people this change.
He said most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. When I first came to AA, I held all things religious or spiritual in absolute, complete contempt. I knew so much about God and spirituality that was wrong, I damn near didn't learn anything that was right. And I almost died from alcoholism. There seems to be one key word running through this entire appendix, and that's the word change. Now, Bill, like all writers, repeats himself quite often. But also, like most good writers, when he repeats himself, he finds a different word which means the same thing, rather than repeat himself over and over using the same word. Let's look on page 569. Let's see how many times he said change and how many different ways he had of saying it. First paragraph, he talked about a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. Second paragraph, he again mentioned personality changes. But then he said a nature of a sudden and spectacular upheaval. An upheaval is to change entirely. Third paragraph, first sentence, he said sudden revolutionary changes. To revolutionize something is to change it entirely. Third paragraph, last sentence, he said, immediate and overwhelming God consciousness. To overwhelm is to change. Third paragraph, last sentence, he said, vast change in feeling and outlook. Fourth paragraph, first sentence, he said, such transformations. To transform is to change. About the middle of the fourth paragraph, he said, a profound alteration. To alter is to change. So the key of this whole thing is to change from what we were when we came here. Restless, irritable, discontented, filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. Completely screwed up in our minds. To somebody that can be sober and peaceful and happy and free and have a little peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. Getting rid of selfishness, trying to change and start helping others, trying to do God's will instead of self-will. A complete change in our personality. That's what he means by spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. It has nothing at all to do with religion.
You've got to be careful with this idea about change, because I told you earlier, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I stood in the back of the rooms and I looked down at my feet and I was ashamed of what I had become. And I did not want to be me. I wanted to be something different than what I was. So I looked around the fellowship and I found me some heroes. We all got to have our heroes for a while. One was George, and the other was my sponsor, Franklin, and later on, Joe and Charlie became my heroes, and I emulated them in every way that I could. I almost made it. See, I was almost like Charlie. Thank God I didn't make it. One Charlie's enough. But the point is, I didn't like me, so I'm trying to be like my heroes, emulating them. And I think the type of change that they're in, that's not bad for a while. The type of change I think they really talk about in this book is to change from what I had become when I arrived here to that which God intends for me to be. That's a marvelous experience in life, to be who you are, just who you are, and not trying to be somebody else all the time. That's a good feeling. And that's the type of change I think they're talking about now. Let's go back to page 25. He said, now, if you're as seriously alcoholic as we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we passed into the region in which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go into the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could.
That's step one.
And the other, to accept spiritual help.
That's step two.
Didn't want to do either one of those. There's got to be an alternative, but there isn't. I had to make a choice between one of those, either go out there and do the very best I can do, or to stay here and try to apply this program to my life. That seems to be the only choice we alcoholics have. Thank God I was able to stick around and to begin to apply these steps and these principles to my life, because I am not what I used to be. I guarantee you on that. I'm just different. I'm becoming what God intended for me to be. And I like who I am today, and I can look you in the eye.